All right, let's take a listen to a few of your call-in questions.
Now, this next person that we have up, I think it's called in before, because there can't be that many people named Saqib in the world. Saqib, are you there?
Yes.
We've done this before, you and I, have we not?
Correct.
You have called That's before. Correct. So go ahead. What's your question this time?
Looking for substitutions for using alcohol in cooking, as I do not consume any alcohol as a Muslim. So, you know, I've seen a lot of your recipes, and you'll be deglazing something with white wine, you're added to like a tomato sauce or whatever, or tequila into like fish taco marinade. So I'm trying to get an idea of what are some good substitutions for something like white wine, red wine, and something special like tequila. I know
sure.
I can't do like the vodka type stuff. That's really dependent on high amount of alcohol, but when I'm looking at flavor.
You know, sometimes alcohol is very difficult to replace. And those are places where we're actually looking for ethanol's chemical abilities to bind to certain things, or it's or it's freezing point or it's boiling point, being very specific. You know, it's hard to replace, for instance, an ice cream, although not impossible. But the instances that you're talking about, I mean, most of the circumstances you just gave me were instances of deglazing. Is that right? Well, in deglazing, you know, what do we primarily want out of a deglaze? Let's think about what the action of deglazing is. Describe it to me. Tell me what you're doing when you're deglazing a pan.
There's fond that develops at the bottom, and then you put in a flavorful liquid to get that fond back into a sauce, and then you also get the added benefit of that flavorful liquid.
Right. Well, what we're really interested then is the water base of the liquid, because it's the water solvent that's doing the actual removing. So first and foremost, we need water. And wine, vodka, whatever, is still mostly water. So what we're going to say at that point is, okay, water. Okay, well, if we're going to imitate the flavors of say, white wine, even a little bit, well, what are we talking about? We're probably talking about a combination of acid and fruit, right? Because, I mean, that's kind of what wine is. So in the case of if I were you, and if I was about to do a recipe where I needed to deglaze a pan with white wine, what I would probably do is I would make a mixture of water, white grape juice, a little bit of a good, you can use white wine vinegar, I assume, because it has no alcohol in it. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. White wine vinegar, and then probably an herb. I would probably add something with a grassy flavor. I might use some thyme, or I might use some oregano, because there are a lot of vegetal grassy flavors in white wine. So I would probably kind of like mix that all up and then deglaze the pan with it. Red wine gets a little trickier, but still, we're talking about water, we're talking about juice, and we're talking about an herbaceous quality, and we're talking about acid. So you can hack that and try a lot of different ways to work that out. But you know, grape juice, either a purple grape juice or a white grape juice, are constituents in wine. You just need some tannin, which can come from herbs and dried fruits. Chopping up some raisins and putting there something else that has some astringency.
Sure.
So just think about what those flavors are and think about how you can replicate them. Because truth is, alcohol is the least important of those, except in an aromatic sense. Because alcohol does, because of the way it boils off and boils out and the way that it works in our noses, most of what it's doing is actually aromatic. So the flavors, you can make that up. What I would not do is I would not cook with a, quote, alcohol-free wine, because they're all wretched.
Right.
I think. So that's what you can do. All right. Well, thanks a lot. So the calls continue to roll in on the Alton Browncast. Folks, oddly enough, wanting to talk about food. I don't know why this is, that would happen. And I think we're now talking to, is it Elena or Alana?
My name's Alana.
Alana. Okay, Alana, how are you? Where are you tonight?
I am calling from Harleysville, PA.
What is your question, madam?
My question is on candy making. I want to start making candy, and I was wondering if you could tell me, after a few failed attempts that I've tried, the best way to flavor hard candy and the best way, if you found, to shape it while it's cooling. I'm having trouble with that. It breaks a lot.
Okay. A couple of things. Number one, my favorite flavorants for hard candy are oils, essential oils, peppermint oil, lemon oil. They tend to, for my money, deliver the most bang for the buck. If you go now, dealing with the hardness issue or the set time issues is kind of a bigger one. Are the recipes that you're currently using call only for sugar for actual sucrose? What are they? Are they asking you to add another sugar or another, you know, like corn syrup or dextrose or some other sugar?
I found one. I started with a glass recipe to make like broken glass. And I kind of went from there, and I found one that calls for caro syrup and cream of tartar, and basically boiling it down and then spreading it on like a silicone sheet.
Yes, ma'am.
And I noticed that goes very fast. And I was wondering if there's...
Now, when you say goes very fast, do you mean that it sets up very quickly?
Yes, I found that it sets very quick.
Okay. Tell me, because I mean, technically speaking, you know, the when we look at a candy recipe like that, when we're trying to make an amorphous candy, one that doesn't have a grain structure, like say fudge, but something that's clear or amorphous, it's basically same as a taffy, only it's cooked even further. We very often will see an acid added to it, like cream of tartar, tartaric acid, which is there to break down some disaccharides or the sucrose into monosaccharides, which changes the character and keeps it from crystallizing. And the caro syrup, the corn syrup, is there essentially for that very, very same reason. It's due to prevent crystallization. You say that it's setting too fast on you. Are you just trying to spread it out nice and thin, and it's just setting before you can get it spread thin?
Yeah, sometimes I've tried to shape it or even roll it, and I feel like parts of it just seems to dry really quick on me. So I have trouble, like when I'm starting to like manipulate it, I can feel like it's already starting to dry.
Well, you know, recipes for anything like a glass are really meant to just pour and set. They're not meant to shape. It's not like you're doing a pulled sugar recipe where you're trying to keep things warm. So, I mean, if it says glass, that's kind of doing what it's supposed to do. You got to pour that stuff out really fast. The only other thing you can do is make sure that you're pouring it onto something warm and that you're in a warm room. I've bought myself a little time sometimes by putting a heating pad under the silicone mat. Or even under the pan that the silicone mat is on, to buy me a little bit of thermal space so that sugar doesn't start to set quite as quickly. I know other people that will hit it with a hairdryer to keep it warm. But a glass recipe, that's supposed to set up pretty quickly. So I think that if you're wanting to shape it, you're going to need to look for a candy recipe that's got a different sugar, either a different actual ingredient list or parts list of sugars, or that doesn't require you cook it to quite the same doneness or ball level or ball stage, as we call it. So you're probably not going to be cooking it quite to the level of concentration that you are with something like a glass, which is a relatively strong, you know, you're way up there in the hard crack stage at that point. So I think that I think you may be trying to get a recipe to do something it's really not designed to do. But if you are wanting to shape, you should go with a recipe that's meant for pulled sugar or shaping or lozenges or something like that. And in that case, you'd probably want to use molds anyway, which are really, really inexpensive and would actually allow you to pour off that glass recipe even into molds, and you'd probably be okay. Let's take a few minutes to deal with some of your culinary questions. Here's one that I should have known was coming. Keith Kedover emailed this to Alton Brown, askalton@altonbrown.com, and said, in your AMA on Reddit, that's an internet thing, you said you've changed your recommendations on boiling pasta. Can you cover that on the podcast? Yeah. Here's the deal. All the stuff that I said about cooking dried pasta on the program that I used to make on Food Network called Good Eats. And the very first season, I did a show on dry pasta, and I stated clearly that I never cooked dry pasta when I didn't bring a gallon of water to a boil. That works. But I don't do that anymore. But it's not like I'm going to go back and change the show, right? I mean, that would be real expensive. And besides, I'd have to gain weight and put hair back into my head, which I'm not going to do. Look, here's the thing. I started you know, as a lot. I mean, I'm not the only person to have been bothered by this. You know, every time you boil, you know, pasta, you cook pasta, you have all this water. If you follow the traditional mindset, and, you know, you bring it to a boil and you put the pasta in, and it still usually sticks together. And so you're standing there stirring. And so myself and others, I mean, Harold McGee's written on this. A lot of people have written on this, started wondering, well, why the heck are we doing this in so much water? And why are we doing this in boiling water? And it turns out, gosh darn it, most of the time, you're just as good off starting your dry pasta in cold water and bringing it just to a simmer. And let me tell you, not that much water. Now, strands are different because, you know, they'll stick up out of the pot. So they require a good bit of water. But shapes like, you know, for farfalle and rigatonis and ziti's and all those other shapes, you know what? I cover them by about half an inch of water and I bring them to the simmer. And by the time the water's at a simmer, the pasta's done. I think it's more toothsome. It doesn't tend to stick nearly as much as it does when it goes into boiling water. So, and then you drain it. So I'm just not doing it anymore. I'm not. And the neat thing about it is that you do end up with a little bit more starch in the water. And that can really be good for thickening sauces. Don't get rid of that water. That is like a great thickener ready to happen. It's a slurry. Look at it that way. It is a starch slurry. So you can save that and you can thicken up a sauce with it or save it for later use. But that's the deal. I no longer bring the water to a boil before I put in the pasta, unless it's long strands. Well, even then I don't do it. I just use more water. And I don't use any more water than I have to cover the pasta. And I know that there are some purists out there. Jada, sorry, I can hear you screaming at me from thousands of miles away, but I'm sticking by my story. All right, here's a question that came in from someone named John into the askalton@altonbrown.com email bag. And this is a good question. It's going to take a little thought. If you could have only 10 spices in your spice box, what 10 would you choose and why? Okay, I've never heard of a spice box, but I guess you mean spice rack, what have you. And of course, spice, we mean not herbs, not the leaf of something, but the seeds, dried fruit, pods, root, bark, etc. So, and you didn't, you know, salt is really a rock, not a spice. So I'm going to leave it off because it's technically not. Maybe thought, you know, I would include that, but I'm not going to because of that. Telecherry black peppers from Telecherry, India. Cumin, very, very old Middle Eastern spice, and probably my very favorite spice. Another Middle Eastern fave, I'm going to go with sumac. Not the same as American sumac, which is poisonous. But sumac in the Middle East, of course, used for acidity, actually in the place of lemon, before there was lemon. So like if you had hummus, it would have sumac in it instead of lemon. I'm a huge fan of it. It's earthy, but tangy and sharp and lemony at the same time. While we're on the kind of sharp, you know, brownish red stuff, I would say smoked paprika. I would say coriander seed. I would say nutmeg for sure. Whole nutmeg, of course. I'd say a cinnamon. More specifically, I'm more of a cassia fan, and cassia is technically a different plant. Most of what people think of in America as cinnamon is actually cassia. Cinnamon's different, fruitier, lighter. I happen to like Indonesian cassias a lot, and also Vietnamese or Saigon cassia I like. So I would want some of that. For heat, I'd probably go with cayenne. I know you would, a lot of folks say, well, that's boring, but you know what? It's called for in a lot of recipes. It's very kind of standardized. You can trust it. So I would go with cayenne. That probably leaves me a couple of more. I might go with, I'm going to stay away from things like fennel. Fennel, you taste fennel and by golly, you know, it's sausage. Your brain says sausage. So I might go, gosh, how many is that? I think that's 8. I might go, celery seed, which I like a lot. No one ever, it's like that old Monty Python skit, you know, at the Inquisition. Nobody expects celery seed. But I like it. And, I would probably go something else unexpected. You know what? I'd go with fenugreek. That would round it out for me. And most of those are available, of course, in, with the exception of, it's hard to get, sumac, is usually ground, paprika, usually ground the cinnamon. I don't have a hammer mill, so I can't grind that, but everything else I could do myself, certainly the, all those seeds. So, that's going to be my list. And I hope you made note of it because I didn't write it down and I don't think I can do it again. So, thanks, John, for your question. Okay. You're listening to the, you're squandering perfectly good time listening to the Alton Browncast. I'm talking with my friend. I will say it. My friend.
What were you
going to
say?
What? Colleague.
Oh, wait, great. So now he has someone that's going to tell him what to say.
My
lovely.
Colleague,
this will be fun.
Jadis de Laurentiis. But no, Jadis, I count as a friend.
Wow.
Because she never gives me.
I've made it into the friend realm. Cool.
Cheers. I can kick you out at a moment's notice. And yes, we're drinking bourbon at 11:20 in the morning.
Oh,
but you,
Lord,
look, listen.
I'm not. Just Alton.
No, you're drinking tequila. You taught me how to drink tequila with orange juice, which, by the way, was a wonderful gift.
It wasn't orange juice.
It's fresh squeezed orange juice. Muddled.
Freshly sliced oranges.
Yes.
Orange juice has sugar. You don't ever want sugar.
People are interested in you. And you brought up something very.
I think people are interested in us.
Okay. But a few moments ago, you said something that was actually interesting, which was that. Which is that people are surprised when they meet you. That you're not what they think you're going to be. Why is it you think that people are surprised when they meet you? I was surprised when I met you.
Yes.
Because you were completely unaffected. And I think that the reason you're completely unaffected is that you were raised in a very different manner. Mm-hmm. And you had an amazingly talented and famous grandfather.
Yes.
Dino De Laurentiis, who I was a fan of my whole filmmaking life. But when I first met you, I was taken aback by your normalcy, by the fact that you seem to be, here's the thing.
Seem
you understand,
is a key word.
No, you understand kidding. The trappings of this business,
yes.
But they do not affect you, nor do they define you. That's not the norm in this business. The norm is that you buy into your own mythology and become that, and you
drink your own Kool-Aid.
You have not drunk your Kool-Aid.
No.
How have you avoided your Kool-Aid?
Well, listen, I always say that this is a job, like any job. I get paid to do a job I really love doing. I'm just lucky to have found something that I truly enjoy doing. But I'm still working just like every other person. I'm no better or no worse than anybody else. And what I just wanted to do was teach people a little bit about Italian culture and about Italian food because I think Americans love Italian food. And I wanted to make it more accessible for them. That's it, period, and a story. Now, the fame and the recognition and all of that stuff came with it, not because I ever seeked it, because if I wanted fame and recognition, I could have become an actress. I could have. I mean, not that I would have been a good one, but I certainly could have tried.
But it would have been a natural progression.
Yes. And I'm not going to tell you I didn't try because my family believed – they didn't really believe in college. My grandfather never even finished high school. You know, he finished grade school. He was a salesman. He could sell his pants off, basically. He could sell you a lump of coal and you would have thought you'd gotten a bag of gold.
Hey, I paid retail to see Dune.
That's sad. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I paid retail.
Just teasing.
I paid like $7.50 to see Dune, so he's a great salesman.
He was a great salesman.
He was fantastic salesman.
He was a great salesman. But he was also very good at making sure that we stayed as grounded as we could and not bought into the hype that we were somehow special. We weren't special. We were lucky. There's a difference.
Do you think that that came out of his own experience and coming out of the war?
He came from nothing. I mean, his parents had a pasta factory, but they just – it wasn't like they were millionaires. And they had 10 children, and the kids all worked.
He was one of 10?
Yes, and they all worked. They
all
worked.
At the factory?
Not at the factory. What they did is they took their parents' pasta and sauces, and they went door-to-door in Naples, in Torre Annunziata, which is a town outside of Naples, and they sold their parents' pasta and sauces. That's the job. Why do you think that
and how old was
they
he
had
when
so
he started
many children?
Doing that?
I think he went with his older sisters, probably starting at the age of 6 or 7, because the younger the child, the cuter it is to, like, you sell more.
Okay. What year was that then? I can't do that much math that fast.
Well, he was born in 19...
He would have, because today is his
13,
birthday.
13, yeah. And he was 94, so do the math.
Somebody do the math.
Did anybody do the math?
Well, my dad, 1929, that'd been 1919.
Yeah. So 1919.
So he was...
But he was born 1919. So we're talking the early 20s. 1920s. Like 20...
What were the 20s like in Italy at the time in Naples? What was it like?
Well, not great. You know, Naples was never a rich town. It was they were always very poor. Well,
Naples is more barrio than anything else.
Yes, it is,
right?
And run by the mafia for the most
part. Especially
yes.
Certain neighborhoods.
Yes.
I mean, that's well known.
Yes. And so,
how did he contend with that?
So, well, I think his parents did for a while. And then,
do you want some more bourbon in your coffee? I saw you put a little bit.
No,
in there.
Thank you. That's why the parents in the end, during World War II, after World War II, lost everything. And my grandfather went into the
army. They lost everything because of the war?
Yes,
or?
Yes. Everybody was devastated at that point. The lower part, the southern part of Italy, was very devastated by the war.
Well, because that's where all the invasion forces came in.
And
of course, Mussolini
didn't
back up.
The north has been supporting the south forever. So there's always been...
Really?
Yes, the north is where the money is. That's where the car industry is, Fiat, all of those companies. All the big corporations are in the north, and they've always resented carrying the south. So that's always been.
But the south
gets
all the tourism money, though, except for Venice. I mean, let's face it.
They do. Well, Florence does. Well, the north is
Florence.
Getting better.
Yeah,
but
right.
But there's a different personification between the two areas. A different type of food, a different style of thinking. It's a totally different world, depending on where you go, north or south.
Is it as different as Northern California and Southern California?
No, it's – no. But good try.
I'm reaching.
Having said that, they lost money. So anyway, what he did was his parents gave him $50 and he moved to Rome. He wanted to be an actor. My grandfather was
– I'm sorry, $50.
Yes. Well
– no, but I mean the equivalent of $50.
The equivalent of $50, maybe a little less. And the dad said to him, this is all I got. If you run out of money and you don't get a job – then you come home, but I'm not sending you anything else. And my grandfather, of course, stubborn as he was like, no, if I run out of money, I figure something out. I'm not coming back. I'm not coming back to this. I want a better life. I want to be an actor. But he realized early on that he could not be an actor. He was short and he wasn't, I mean, he was a good looking guy, but you know, he wasn't Clark Gable. So having said that, because he's such a good salesman, he ended up marrying Miss Rome, who happened to be my grandmother, who was an up-and-coming starlet. And together, they built an empire. She was the actress. He produced the movies. And they sold them together. It's like a Ben and Angelina kind of thing.
It's
Brad and Angelina.
Yeah, except your grandfather was not Brad.
I know.
I mean, because I've seen pictures of them.
But the idea was they were a power couple. I guess that's where I'm going.
They were a power
this.
Couple. But what was so intriguing about them is that they were, when you look at pictures, and I've gone back and looked, and there are pictures of them.
Wow.
Where it's like, this would not happen in Hollywood, because he was not the guy physically that should have been with Miss Rome. But there was always this gleam in his eye that said, you don't know the half of it,
right.
Which was the beautiful thing about Dino. For those of us that like grew up on his movies and stuff, you were like, he always knew something and was always up to something in his head that you didn't know. And the fact that he got her only made him cooler.
Yes, and I think that...
she was totally hot.
She was, yes. My grandmother was very hot. And I think that... I think that you start to learn that there's more than just what meets the eye to a lot of people. It's not... And I think that's what I've always tried to explain to people or show people is that I may look a certain way on the outside, but there's a lot more to me than just that.
Just what?
Just what you see. Meaning... in photographs or however you want to perceive who I am. You know, I've spent a lot of time in my career playing down the way I look, my looks, because they don't really coincide well with what I do for a living.
How do you look to you? What do you see?
What is this, therapy? I see a pretty shy woman, believe it or not, because I've always been shy, who is very passionate about what they do and to some extent just really and truly wants to make people happy one way or the other. I happen to do it through food, but I want people to be happy. I see a lot of unhappy people in just walking around. And I think that life is too short. You know, you have to remember, too, I lost my one of the most special people in my life, which was my brother, at a very early age. He died when he was 30 and I was 33. And that was a defining moment in my life. Yeah. Where I realized, stop wasting your time. Do exactly what you want to do and work as hard as you can at it. And but be real to who you are and don't change who you are in the process of doing that. And I think I realized that I want to live life every day to the fullest. And my goal here is to help people smile a little more. I think at the end of the day, that's really all I want. And I don't see all this beauty on the outside that people see when they see me. I just don't. But I like the idea that I can redefine what cooking means and what cooking is, that you can enjoy eating and cooking and you don't have to have to look a certain way or be a certain weight. I feel like there's a stereotypical sort of definition of who someone like me should look and be like, and I don't fit that model, and I think that's kind of fun.
What should somebody like you be like?
Well, I think that a person like myself maybe shouldn't care so much about the way they dress or the way they look or that they are thin or that they...
Are you true to who you are? Do you feel you can or do you...
I've always been this way. My grandmother was like this. My mother was like this. This is how I sort of, you know, my grandmother was perfect from even when she was in bed sleeping at night. You know, she never went to bed with boxer shorts and a t-shirt. Never. My grandmother was in...
Do you?
I do not.
Okay, just check.
I do not. But we wore, you know, I was brought up in a world where a woman is dressed nice to go to bed, even if you're going to bed by yourself.
Because you never know what can happen. Well, the night is long.
The fire alarm.
The night is long and dark.
No, but like you are always... I think that the way you present yourself in life in any moment of your life really defines how you feel about yourself. And so I always like to feel pretty. And that's a different definition for everyone. Pretty, when you look at yourself in the mirror, can be different for everyone.
Do you think that most women do not afford themselves that?
Yes.
So you and...
Because they either feel like they don't have time, or they don't feel like putting the effort, or they just don't feel good enough about themselves to feel like they deserve it.
Are you beautiful?
Well...
And if so, let me just show where I'm going with that. If so, where does it come from and what part of you do you consider to be beautiful?
You know, I would tell you that I think the most beautiful thing about me probably is probably my smile and my teeth. I love my teeth. I had the ugliest teeth when I was 12 years old and I put braces on and now I love my teeth. I take such good care of my teeth.
But your point about beauty, and I think this is actually important because I think a lot of young ladies look up to you. You know, I have a 13-year-old daughter and I worry constantly about what she thinks is beautiful, what everybody else might think is beautiful in a relationship. And she just happens to be physically very beautiful, but I don't want people to necessarily think that's where her beauty comes from. And so girls look up to you because you're a smart businesswoman. You're a really great cook. Your authority.
Oh my gosh, Alton just said I was a really good
cook.
You're
a very, very good cook. I will admit that I have a set of cookbooks that are in my kitchen that I actually cook from. And yes, I cook. I cook from your book more than I cook from Marcella Hazan's book, okay? So there you go. That's
wow,
kind of where you were in on things. Because you know why? Because you manage to create...
They're easier, that's all. Because Marcella makes some great food.
No, they're faster. Mm. They're faster by and large and can be made more with foods that I can get my hands on very quickly, which sometimes, you know, really matters.
Which is the whole point of what I do.
Which
I'm not trying
sense.
To compete with... You know.
But like my daughter looks up to you and likes you because you have an individual style and you don't seem to really give a damn what anybody thinks. which I think is great. And I tell her, that's good. Be that way.
Yeah, that, I will be honest and tell you that that came at later in life. I mean, I'm not that old. I'm totally making it sound
no,
like I'm 60.
I mean, what could you do in 25 years?
I'm 42 years old and soon to be 43.
You have a birthday coming up very soon.
I do have a birthday coming up soon. And I only realized that after I had my daughter. I realized, well, I spent my 20s. First of all, I will say
I've been. You married young.
Well, not really. I married
at 30. You met your husband very
young. I met Todd when I was 19. I've been with Todd 23 years.
28.
Yes. We've been together 23 years. So we've been together a long time. But I spent most of my 20s and early 30s, you know, sort of, yes, working, going to college and doing all that. But a lot of the time, really caring about what other people thought of me, truly. And especially, I cared a lot about what Todd thought and what his friends thought. And I worked really hard at trying to make them all love me. His family, his everybody.
Was that something your grandma had done or something the other women in your world had done? Make other people love them?
No.
Or were you afraid that you couldn't do it naturally
Correct.
The way they had?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I wasn't secure enough in who I was. But the other thing was, too, is that I have a very strong family. They're all very, very strong personalities. And so you have to sort of find your way within that world.
You have
to find your voice.
Within that world?
Sure. And, you know, women in my family, my grandfather really thought, you know, women get married, they have kids. They don't go have careers. So when I wanted my career and I had been with Todd about, at that point, 10 years, he was like, what are you doing? You're going to be an old maid and no one's going to want you. Like, you're spending all this time with this guy. But you need to make this legit. And you're going to get to a certain age and no one's going to want you anymore.
You'll be just all dried up.
You're dried up. Yeah. And I thought, oh, shit, right. Like, I should think about that. I should really be thinking about that. And then 13 years into the relationship, then Todd all of a sudden decided, you know, men turn 40 and all of a sudden they're like,
how did you maintain one relationship before being married for that many years? I mean, that's not.
Well, first of all, I would say that Todd was very supportive of whatever it was I wanted to do. So when I wanted to go to culinary school in Paris, he was very supportive of that. He would come and visit, but he encouraged me to do those things. I don't think that it would have lasted that long had he not been that person and not afraid to see me flourish, to see me gain all of the things I ever dreamed of. That is not easy for a lot of men.
No, it is not.
Most men would like to just keep you the way you are. Now,
no, it's scary.
Yes, he was not that type of man because he was very secure in who he was.
Nice. Okay, I get that.
Thanks 100%. To his upbringing. So that's probably part of it. At this stage in my life, I always say if I wasn't with Todd, I probably would be alone because when you become a personality, it's hard to, like you said, it's hard to find people that you trust. And
because you don't know who's talking to you and who's talking to the TV.
Right, and also as a woman, I hate to say this, but there aren't a lot of men who want a power, like a strong woman who makes her own money, who doesn't rely on a man. There's not many men that want that. Most men would like to have a woman they take care of.
I just want to say I would be more than happy to be taken care of by a powerful, rich, beautiful woman. I mean, anybody here have a problem with that? I'm in. I'm just saying.
That's what all men say but
until
when
it
they're
happens.
In it, I've seen it because I have friends who have been divorced and have jobs and are powerful and have their own money. And
I'm belittling it, but you know,
are.
Men, we are wired to be useful that way.
Correct.
And to take care of a family and to earn.
Yes, that is we're
the hunter gatherers.
Yes.
Because I know that you're a very involved mom. You talk about Jade all the time, but you are gone a lot. How do you work that? How do you jibe that?
Well, first of all, it wouldn't be possible without Todd because he gets up in the morning. He has a job, obviously, but he gets her up in the morning. He doesn't travel like I do.
So we're talking about a pretty great dad here.
Yeah. He's a pretty extraordinary person. So I do my best to insert myself in her life, even if I'm not there. And sometimes it's difficult to let go when I'm not there, meaning allowing Todd to make decisions that I usually make when I'm home and understanding that I have to take a back seat if I'm not, you know. The rules are whatever dad says when dad's with you and vice versa. And if dad's with you more than mom, then dad's way goes more than mine, even if I don't agree with the particular choice.
Yeah, but you can't.
No, but it's hard.
You got to back it up. Yeah,
I have to back it up, but it is very hard. And as she gets older, she understands that a little bit more.
But you guys have made a choice to, this is the way you live, this is the way you make your living, and this is the way.
Well, I don't know if we made a choice. I think that I said to Todd, I really enjoy my life and my job, and I don't want to give it up. Don't make me, type of thing. And I think we both think like, well, how long can this really continue? So at some point, I've always, in this business, I've always thought, well, at some point it probably will end. So maybe I just like enjoy it while I have it because it's not going to be here forever, type of thing. So Todd's always like, well, maybe next year the year is going to be lighter and you're going to be home more. Like, I think that's sort of the idea rather than the thought
that. Is that the
hope? I don't know if it's the hope. I just think that maybe that's the hope for Todd. Yeah. I don't know that it's my hope.
What is your hope? If the clock is indeed ticking on your career, and any of us who think that that's not happening
are nuts,
nuts and naive. So what is it that you hope for whatever it is that the time that you have left?
My dream is that I can do more than just be a food personality.
Okay, what?
Well, I think that...
And number one, you are more than a food personality, okay?
Not yet.
No, what I mean is a food personality doesn't necessarily have authority, doesn't necessarily have the trust of people. I mean, there are a lot of people that when they say, I want to make something Italian, open one of your books. That's powerful and that's meaningful.
That's a food personality.
No, that's okay. More than a food personality. Yes, that's in the food genre, but a personality could be somebody who just hosts a bunch of shows. Once you start being responsible for the food that goes on somebody's plate, once you... That's inside the home. That's infiltrating at a different level than just a personality.
Okay. That's part of drinking your own Kool-Aid.
I don't know that.
Really? I do.
I don't. The fact that when a lot of people say, I'm going to make something Italian, they open your book and they trust you and they cook your food and they put it on the plate
that.
And they
that
eat
makes,
it.
That makes me feel like I'm doing my job.
I'm just saying it's more than just wonderful. A personality.
Okay.
I mean, a personality can just be somebody who hosts a food show. You are more than that.
I do that too, though.
Yeah, we all do.
Sometimes I feel like a talking head.
All right, go on. Do you? Yeah.
So I guess for me, I would, and I'm trying to do this in the sense like that's why I am a spokesperson for Clairol. That's why I'd like to break out of just, I want people to understand that you don't have to be pigeonholed into doing only one thing well, that you can do several different things well. And I would like to broaden my brand to expand beyond just food. And not that food is not a wonderful thing, but I think to stay unique in the marketplace and to stand out, you need to branch out the way you're doing as well with your podcasts and your on the road stuff and, you know.
Well, you've got to find your own edges, the edges of
your
own
map. Yeah, I don't want to just like host shows, food shows
I don't either.
5 to 10 years. I would like to do more than that.
So can you give me three things that you would really love to do that you think might be outside the realm of immediate possibility? I'd like to know what some of your dreams are.
I would like to...
Because you understand that a lot of people just would dream, their wildest dreams would be to have what you have already.
I know. And that's why it's hard to
and
talk about that.
And I'm not belittling your dreams.
And that's why I think, you know... But I think it's good in life that when you achieve one thing, that you always try to achieve a little bit more. And
absolutely.
I'm not saying that you aren't grateful. I'm grateful. Of course I am. I never thought in a million years I'd even get this far. Are you crazy? I come from like a totally different background.
Understood.
But I would like to actually kind of go back to that a little bit. I would like to make a movie. Maybe about food. I would like to bring more food genre into TV shows. Maybe a sitcom. I would like to broaden my beauty line. My beauty sort of foray, which I've started to do with Clairol. I would like to hopefully, let's see how this restaurant goes. I would like to do maybe more of a fast food sort of idea, concept. I would like to also broaden my brand into Europe, which and the rest of the world. But like I have a kids book, you know, adventure book that comes out in September. That's a new thing. That's a bit of a departure. Always staying true to my brand, which is obviously Italian food and food in general, but still trying to escape, just not escape, but like broaden it a little bit. And I think that the kids' book is a little bit of that. And these are all passion projects. I have an e-magazine that's coming out weekly. I have different little projects that are small. They're small. They're not money makers. They're not – in fact, I pay for them mostly. So – but they're little baby steps into doing something a little bit different. Not entirely different, but a little bit different.
Okay. I get brand. What about you? Can you separate yourself from the brand?
But Jada is it. I mean, I am that.
Yes.
That's me.
We are each our brands. But when you just think of the thing you want to do, not the place you want to take your brand, but just the thing you would like to do.
I would like to maybe – I would like very similarly to you – I would like to have one show I do, maybe a talk show, where I'm in one place and I know where I'm going every day and I know who I'm going to be with every day. And I think to me that would be the ideal, and I think it's probably something that you like as well. I know that there's other people out there, Bobby Flay. There's a lot of other people who feel the same way. All right, so quick question.
Oh, you say – because you said you were going to ask me questions.
Yeah, I want to know –
where are they at?
We did a few months ago in Los Angeles, you, me, and Bobby sat down in front of a group of people from the Academy.
When we did the Emmy thing.
Emmy thing, yeah, which we didn't get. So you left that evening and you looked at me and you go, I actually learned something new about you or something interesting about you. And I thought, what could you have possibly learned you didn't already know? So what did you learn that evening? I have been thinking about it for a long time, and I'm just very curious.
Whenever you talk about your upbringing and you talk about your past, you're very different. You are. I've been around you enough now to where it's like I was watching you, and you know you've got this one layer of you that's completely honest and true, which is like you with other people. But when you talk about the things that made you who you are a little bit different, and you are kind of lonely.
Wow.
I
that's
feel
an insight
like you're
I've
a little
not heard
lonely.
Before.
And one of the reasons I think you're kind of lonely is that you are constantly fighting a battle of the significance of who you are and what you do with against the way that people perceive you, which is greatly through the way you look.
Correct.
And you are constantly at battle with that.
And it probably always will be.
And, you know, there are people that would say that's a high-class problem.
Totally, which is why I don't normally talk about it.
But the thing is that...
it's still a battle nonetheless.
It's still a battle because somewhere deep down you know that there's someone out there not taking you quite as seriously. Mm-hmm. Because they stop considering you at the surface.
Correct.
And that pisses you off, as well it should. Now, those people that spend time around you and get to know you realize that your veneer and your facade, that outer part of you, is part of you, but is by no means defining of you.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination.
When I first went to college at Pepperdine, before I went to UCLA, I studied to become a therapist, a psychologist.
But your degree's in anthropology.
Correct. I switched. After a semester, I was like, I can't take this. I just can't. I can't do this as a life's work. I think I might not make it if
would,
I do
would
that.
Not. Well,
no.
Because it would.
But I always have been a good. All my friends will always say, "We don't know. You don't tell us a lot about yourself, but you sure listen to our problems and try to help us as much as you can."
But you listen genuinely. We shot this thing down in Miami. Remember that day that we were all at this house doing this like grilling thing? But we all were hanging around for a day.
Yes.
We all
a long time
a
ago.
A whole
long
bunch of
time
us.
Ago.
Mm-hmm. It was probably eight years ago.
Oh yeah.
And my wife was with me, and she commented that when you talked to her, you actually talked to her. You weren't talking to Alton's wife. She's like, you were genuinely interested in talking to her, and you listened to her. And because she has spent so much time around showbiz folk,
sure,
she knows when she's getting – 90% of the people
look
through her to other people in the room or
by the
over
way,
her
have
or
you
at
ever
me.
Even noticed when we sit and talk to even within our own group that there's people when you talk to them they're like
sure
and I want to go I'm over here what are you doing.
Bobby's one of the only people when I first came to this network in 1999 that paid me any attention or listened to what I said. Oh. And he gave me great – no, I'm just saying, and he gave me great advice.
It's funny how the first impression from anybody really sticks with you.
Hugely.
Doesn't matter two what people, they almost do later on, nope. Unless it's like
– two people paid real attention to me and listened to me and was interested in me. Mario Batali was, and I will never forget, the day that I met Mario Batali was the day after he had won the Beard Award for Best Chef New York. And he came up to me and he said, "You've got something on your cheek." And he licked his shirt and like scraped it off of me. And I was like, you know, really?
No, he's
like,
saliva.
I was like his 4-year-old or something. I was like, "Thanks, chef. Congratulations on your Beard Award." And then the other person was Bobby, who had actually bothered to watch my show. And the great piece of advice that he gave me, by the way.
He knows good talent, that's for sure.
And he had great business advice. And we had gotten in this conversation, and he said, "Never take from a partner what you can borrow from a bank." And I was like, whoa. And I have actually lived by it ever since, and it was really great advice. Other people treated me like I should carry their bags. Mario and Bobby did not.
You
need
to do a podcast with Mario. He'd be so good at it. Anyway.
He's an incredibly smart guy, mm-hmm. and a very, very good cook.
I adore Mario, and I think that the...
Are you still pissed off about it, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Why do you think that happened? Let's reset the stage, shall we?
I wish that I had...
It was you and Bobby Flay against Mario Batali and Rachel Ray, and they won.
Mario and Rachel won. I have always been a huge, huge, like you, fan of Mario's, obviously. He was like a mentor to me. I think he loves me and he hates me all in one.
Why does he hate you?
Well, because I came on when he was doing Italian food and I was the only other Italian person and now he's gone. And I think he feels like my looks are the reason that I became successful, which is okay.
Really?
I think he thinks I have some talent too. I'm not saying he doesn't think that. But he's been very, very, very open about the fact that he felt like, you know, my looks, whatever. That is the reason that I have become so successful. And I've always said that would have been true if I would only have been successful for a short amount of time. But I've been here now 12 years. I don't think that's the only reason. But having said that, he was like a mentor. So what hurt my feelings, or I guess why I was heartbroken, is because he asked to have Rachel as his partner. And not that I'm unhappy that Bobby asked me to be his partner, but I was just a little... I thought, well, wouldn't it be more fun if the two Italians were together? What I'm saying is, as a chef, as an artist myself, yes. I can see what he is. And so, he is above and beyond me and always will be. I'm never
so
going to reach
disappointed.
That. I was just disappointed because I wanted to be with what I see as a god, in a way, in my life, in my world.
And he rejected you.
Correct.
For Rachel.
Right.
And why do you think he did that?
I have no idea. Because maybe at the time he was better friends with her, because we hadn't really been socializing as much at that time.
I'm rolling my eyes.
I know you're rolling your
eyes.
Because
I don't think you believe that. Because you're smarter than that.
Maybe he picked her because he knew that he could be in control of that situation.
No, it's because he knew that he could pick her and beat you.
But, oh, right. Because he wanted to beat me.
Because he wanted to beat you.
Sure. But did he really care to beat me, really? He already knows he's better than me. Like,
knowing it and doing it in front of a bunch of million people is different.
Okay. Or did he really just want to beat Bobby? He doesn't care about Bobby. Okay. I guess I never really looked at it that way, to be honest, Alton. I didn't. I never actually thought he would even care that much. So I lost in front of one of the biggest viewership that Iron Chef America has ever had.
And you're not used to losing, are you?
And I was very disappointed, and I took it out on Bobby. And I didn't speak to him.
It wasn't
for 6 months. I refused to speak to him.
Why? What had he done to you?
I felt like he did not. Well, I didn't feel like he practiced with me enough, and I didn't feel like he took it seriously. And to him, winning or losing didn't matter. And to me, it meant everything. And I told him that when I accepted the battle. And also because everybody on my team, John Rosen, my husband, everybody said to me, "Do not do this. Don't do it, because the people that are judging, they're not real critics. You know, they're just, it's a matter of opinion, and battles of that nature never turn out well. And I don't think you should put yourself at risk in that way." And I thought, no, but this will be fun. It'll make me feel like a chef. It'll, like, I'll
make
feel
you feel like a shit.
Oh, no. People will take me seriously if I do a battle of this nature. Because, look, Alex Tarantelli and I had this long discussion about why did she care to be an Iron Chef so badly. Because women aren't taken seriously in this business, no matter how hard you work. And I thought, if I could do it and win it, then people would see me as a real chef. In my chef whites, watching me battle and cook and actually make my own food under pressure, I thought, you know, this could have people see me in a different light that they're not used to seeing me, not all glammed up. And
is that the real you? Is that how you see you?
Yeah. But I've done it. I know I can do it. I did it for a long time.
All right, so you went and you cooked.
I cooked and I lost.
And you got killed.
I got killed and I was heartbroken, and I could not look or speak to Bobby Flay for a minimum of 6 months.
How did you guys bounce back?
We were in South Beach, and we were at a party, and his wife came up to me, and she said, Jada, I think that you and Bobby need to, like, have a conversation. I think it's time you had a conversation. And I said, who, by the way, his wife is?
Stephanie March.
She's
pretty spectacular.
A lovely human being. Like, one of the charming, smart, beautiful, another woman who has a lot more than just her looks, and she's stunning. And I said, well, what's the big deal? Like, who cares? Like, at this point, it's been like 6 or 8 months now. Who cares? Like, and she said, well, I think he cares. And I think he's hurt because he doesn't understand why you're so angry. And I said, all right, I'll explain it to him.
And you did.
And I did.
And what did he say?
He apologized. He said, to me, it was just another battle. I did not realize what it meant to you. You probably should have shared that with me. You did not. I didn't know. I don't read minds. And had I known how much it meant to you, I would have played my cards differently. And
did you not let him know how much it meant to you? Were you,
no,
like, trying to be cool about it?
Yeah. I thought we were going to win. He told me we were going to win.
He told you were going to win.
He said we had it in the bag, which, you know, I learned my lesson. Listen, I make mistakes. I don't make them again. I learned. That's it. Done. Finished. And they have asked me repeatedly to do it again, and I've always said no. I did it. I lost. I will live with that loss, but I am not going to repeat it, and I don't do that again. It's over. Those days are done. And it actually caused me not to trust for a while. And it's taken Bobby and I a long time to get back to where we could actually be friends in that sense of trusting whatever. And I think we're in a good place now, but it took a long time.
I'll do my best not to cross you.
You do that, Alton Brown.
I might come right up on the edge of it. Because you're funny.
We do have a lot of laughs. The jobs that we've done together, we have had a lot of laughs. I would say that Food Network star, you know, I think that I've had a lot of fun working with you.
And I think what's interesting is that we have fun
when you go to work.
But we have fun in a way that the audience also responds to very well. Every time.
If they show it.
True.
When they show it.
And when they show it.
If they show it.
I don't know about you, but I mean, I get stuff on Twitter constantly about you and I.
Really?
It's like, oh, you're just like brother and sister, this and that, and the other. People love our thing.
Banter.
They like our banter a lot.
And I think that that's what makes it unique. And I think that that's what changes it from a talking head, a hosting job.
Yep.
To something a little bit more interactive. And plus, people want to see all of us together. Like, we are going to do this Thanksgiving special.
Yes, we are.
With Ina Garten.
Which is kind of scary. I've never even met her.
Yeah, she feels the same way. So we're going to have dinner.
You've met her?
Yeah. Ina and I are good friends.
Are you?
Yes.
Okay, see, I have no reason to believe that she actually exists because I've never seen.
Yeah. So she does exist. She is also a little apprehensive with the fact that she does not know you and she's never worked with you. I assured her that you are a blast to be around.
Oh, thanks.
But what I also suggested...
No, I got that to live up to.
I suggested we all have a drink the evening before so that we can sort of get comfortable
around
each other.
The evening before? That's gotten it a little close. Don't you think we might do it a little before then?
Well, I think it's difficult to get us all in one place. So she suggested we have dinner instead.
Where? In the
she...
Hamptons.
Okay. No.
Where?
Where
does she want to have dinner?
She asked me to coordinate. So I have now become the coordinator of the evening. So I need to coordinate with you
This is going to be the
Bobby
night before?
Bobby and his people. Ina and her people.
This is going to be the night before we actually shoot the live show?
Correct. But Alton, I don't know. I don't think she's going to come in any more than... I mean, I think she's only coming in the day before. How am I going to organize anything else? I mean, I could try, but honestly, that's difficult. I am not anybody's assistant here. So if you could just make it happen, I've done live stuff.
Bobby's done live stuff,
and we've all three done live stuff together.
Has she done live stuff?
No.
And
that is why I think it would be nice if we spent some time together chatting, so that that day it didn't seem like Jada had to do all the work to keep everybody interactive.
That's going to be interesting.
So please help me.
Yes, I will.
Take the stress off of me a bit.
Yes, ma'am.
And let's have dinner the night before. Okay. Bring your best game forward and be as kind as you can at the beginning.
Do I need to be kind?
If I had a house, I would cook dinner for everyone, but I don't. So unless you want to come to my hotel room where I can make you something in a microwave, I suggest we go out to eat, and I will
coordinate. Wait a second. I want to think this through. Your palatial suite at the not-to-be-mentioned hotel, because people will stalk you there. You could have a kitchen installed, and we could.
Anyway, I thought we'd go out to eat, and then we'll see how Thanksgiving goes.
All right, Jada. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
On every Alton Browncast, we like to follow up the interview with something culinary in nature that you know, was inspired by the interview. Now, obviously, with somebody like Jada, we could go with any Italian item, but I thought that really what I wanted to talk about was meatballs. A lot of people think that the meatballs are, you know, specifically Italian, but there are meatballs all over the place. In Austria, they have these little fried meatballs called Fleischleibchen, I think is how you say that. If somebody knows a better way of saying that, let me know. There are, of course, a lot of meatballs in Chinese cuisine. Greece, we've got kefires, right, which usually have mint in them. Iran, kufte, it means minced. There's a meatball in the Philippines. Maybe if anybody remembers what this is called, tweet me or something. Let me know what it is. But it's usually served. They serve them with squash and fried pork cracklings, which sounds pretty fantastic. And then, of course, in Latin America, we've got albondigas. So there are meatballs everywhere. But here in America, the meatballs that we tend to go for are Italian in origin or Italian in flavor. And that's certainly the way that I'm going to go today. Now, the cool thing about meatballs is they're systematic. You can build them and change them as long as you stick with a kind of construction model that has, to my mind, four specific parts. All right, there's meat, there's a binder, there are fillers, and then there are seasonings. Okay, now meat. I tend to use a mixture of meat, and I will change the ratio depending on kind of what culture, what part of the world I'm chasing. I guess I'm trying to say what I like is an equal mixture, thirds of pork, beef, and lamb. Now, the ground pork is there for texture and fat. The beef, I like either round or sirloin. That's for flavor and a bit of toothsomeness. And I like lamb because it just, well, heck, I like it. The fat content of lamb, that lanolin in lamb, I like the feel of it. And I think that it also gives the meatball just a little bit of funk. Because, you know, lamb's a little funky. If you want it really funky, use mutton if you can find it. I do know I have an Israeli friend that makes meatballs that he's adapted from recipes that use pork by using turkey, ground turkey. I haven't had as much luck with that because I just don't think the fat content is the same, but they've got really good turkeys in Israel. Did you know that? I mean, turkey, there's a big turkey industry in Israel, and Israelis eat more turkey than Americans do, which is really, really interesting. Anyway, so I go always with these the mixture of these meats. My binder, I mean, we're talking about an egg. That's just it. This is the glue that is going to bring everything together, essentially the emulsifier for this force meat. Because, I mean, what is a meatball really but a spherical sausage when you think about it? Fillers. They're, you know, a filler has a couple of different uses, all right? When things are, you know, tight around the old household and, you know, you can't afford a lot of meat, fillers were there to stretch the meat. This is the, you know, in the classic American meatloaf, which, by the way, is just a big meatball. You know, you would add oatmeal or leftover rice or some kind of starch to just bulk the thing up. But fillers also supply a lot of the texture of a meatball, and they tend to hold in juices, okay? If it's a starch like cereal or breadcrumbs or potato chips, it soaks up and holds on to some juices so that the meatball can be juicier. Because believe it or not, even if you cook your meatballs in a big old pot of tomato sauce, you can dry those suckers out until they're hard as marbles, believe you me, and you don't want to do that. I tend to use a mixture of fillers. And I will classify certain foods as fillers that some folks might. For instance, as you'll see in a minute, because I'm going to go over this recipe that I really like, or application, I should say, ground Parmesan cheese even serves as a filler because it doesn't really melt and I integrate it throughout. So I consider that a filler. Oatmeal breadcrumbs, cooked rice, farina can certainly be used. And I also use vegetables as fillers, as you'll soon see. And then we've got seasonings. And of course, there you can just go hog wild. You can use herbs, you can use spices, fresh or dry. I typically use dry. And also liquids, things like fish sauce or Worcestershire sauce or balsamic vinegar. But those things are usually used in a relatively small amount. So I'm going to go over my everyday meatball recipe. This is something that I did on Good Eats, but I change it up quite a bit, you know, depending on what I have. But this is kind of the recipe that's magnetized, you know, stuck with a magnet onto the side of the refrigerator because we do it so often. And I do break it down into the meat, the binder, and the filler. So the way I've got it kind of memorized is it's 8 ounces of three meats, okay? 8 ounces ground pork, 8 ounces ground lamb, 8 ounces ground beef. And again, I'm either going to use round or sirloin, never something like chuck. It's too fatty in this case. I'm after a real strong beef flavor. My binder, always one large egg for this amount. That's 1.5 pounds of meat, and one egg is fine for that. Then come my fillers. And in this case, I use a little bit of breadcrumb, okay, 1/4 cup of breadcrumb. And I mean, I make my own breadcrumbs because we always have bread that's stale around here. So I take whatever bread is the most stale. If I know I'm going to make meatballs, I'll leave it out so it gets hard as a rock, and then I'll run it through the food processor. There's absolutely no reason to buy breadcrumbs. And you certainly, if you are going to, you know, the only kind of purchased breadcrumbs I have are panko breadcrumbs because I can't make them. But don't use those for this. So breadcrumbs, 1/4 cup, finely ground. I also will be using 5 ounces of frozen spinach. Okay, I thaw that, drain it, literally put it in between paper towels and squeeze it dry. I want it as dry as I can get it. 1/2 cup of Parmesan cheese, finely grated. Yes, that is a flavorant, but it is also a filler in this case. That's how I look at it. Okay, so that's kind of the engine room. I got the meat. I've got the binder with the egg. I've got fillers. Okay, filler with the frozen spinach and the parm. Then I've got seasonings. And in my case, my standard mixture is 1.5 teaspoons each of dried basil and dried parsley. Do I dry my own parsley? Yeah, I do because it's easy to dry. I do, however, buy dried basil because I tend to never have any decent basil around. And if I do, I make pesto out of it. I also use 1 teaspoon of garlic powder. I don't think there's any shame in using garlic powder. Just use good garlic powder. I get mine from the Spice House. You've heard me go on about those, spicehouse.com in Evanston, Illinois. They do not pay me to say that. I just think they're really good at what they do. 1 teaspoon of kosher salt. And I like some spice, so I go with red pepper flake. And I'm talking about the kind of red pepper flake that you would get out of a shaker at a pizza place. I go with about 1/2 teaspoon of that. Sometimes I up it a little bit. All right, so the pork, the lamb, the beef, the spinach, the cheese, the egg, the basil, the parsley, garlic powder, salt, red pepper flakes, and 1/4 cup of breadcrumbs go just into a really big bowl. You got to mix it up very, very thoroughly, but try not to crush it. Use your fingers. The less you crush that meat, the less grainy the potential final meatball will be. Yeah, that's something that James Beard used to write a lot about, especially when making things like burgers. Like you can't squeeze the meat and compact it. Always work with your fingertips. And you do have to use your fingers. If I find out you're using spoons to mix this up, I'm going to be really mad because, you know, God gave you these wonderful things on the ends of your arms called hands, and they've got fingers on them, and they're perfect for this. Just wash them. So mix this up, get it very well incorporated, but try not to squeeze the bejeebers out of it. You can use it right away. I like to let it sit in the refrigerator for a while. I think that it helps. Everything kind of soaks up some of the moisture from the egg, and it becomes easier to roll into meatballs if you give it a few hours. You can even go as much as 24 hours. Just be sure you cover it. And when I say cover it, I mean like press wax paper or plastic wrap right down onto the surface of the meat. Don't just cover the bowl. Cover the meat, or you could put it all into a zip top bag if you want, and just suck out the air and let it sit for up to 2 days. So get that done. Then when you're ready to actually make the meatballs, I've got kind of a weird way of doing this. I am a dry meatball cooker guy. I don't like to poach mine because I really like the flavors that dry heat bring to meat. I like a little sear on them. And I found that the best way to get that is with a mini muffin pan. Now, you can make really big honking meatballs, which is fine. And I do that sometimes in the winter, but most of the time I'm using little ones. You can do that in regular muffin tins. I like the mini muffin tins, and I put one meatball in each little hole in the tin, and I roast them, and I get this really wonderful complete surrounding crust on them that brings a lot of flavor to the party. So 400 degree oven. All right. Get your oven cranked to 400. Get yourself another bowl and put, or actually a pie pan. I usually use a pie pan for this. I put another quarter of a cup of breadcrumbs, the same breadcrumbs that I put in the meatballs. I put in a bowl. Okay. And then what you want to do is you want to dose out 1.5 ounce size portions. Now, what I typically do is I'll weigh the first few of them to get a feel for what 1.5 ounces looks and feels like. But you know what, if you want, just scale all of them. You know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. If you want them uniform, scale them. You know, you can be a little bit off, but you know, it'll help you to get the right number and to make sure that you can fill the muffin tin. And by the way, if you're going to use, when you're doing something like this on a scale, I always cover the scale because I use a flat top digital scale. I always cover it with plastic wrap because I don't want to have to wash it. So I use a little plastic wrap to, you know, keep the meat and the scale separated. So portion into 1.5 ounce portions, and then kind of put all those little blobs on a sheet pan or on the counter. I don't care. Then roll each one into a round, and then roll around in the breadcrumbs. You just want a little bit of coating of the breadcrumbs on the outside. Then put them into the muffin tin cups. Bake for 20 minutes or until they're kind of golden brown on the outside, and then use them as you will. I usually let them cool, bag them up, and I'll freeze them. I'll make big batches of these, and I'll freeze them so I always have them and can drop them into pasta sauce or whatever. If you want to eat them right away, I usually just cook up some pasta and toss it in olive oil and herbs and just put the meatballs right into it. The spinach, I think, is kind of really nice. Bring some flavor. There's that green there. And I, you know what? I don't think I ever make meatballs that I don't put some form of vegetation in there. You know, dried mushrooms. I sometimes will switch out the spinach and use dried mushrooms, porcinis. I'll chop those up and rehydrate them sometimes in a little wine, but not rehydrate them all the way, but only partially, because that way they can still suck up some of the moisture in the meatballs. I'll dehydrate them just enough so I can like easily chop them up with a knife. Those are fantastic. Those are fantastic in there. If you like more of a Greek thing, you can change out the Parmesan for a hard crumbly feta, and add fresh mint instead, and up the lamb amount. So you can play with these a lot of different ways, as long as you stick with that. You know, keep in mind, I need meat, I need filler, I need binder, I need seasonings. Anyway, that's how I do it. We eat a lot of those around here. And let me tell you, you can make a pretty powerful meatball sub with tomato sauce and those little roasted meatballs. It's good stuff. All right, food fans, that's about it for today's show. This has been the Alton Brown Cast. I'm Alton Brown. I want to say a special thank you to Jada De Laurentiis for spending so much of her time, you know, talking to me. I just want to say that, you know, there were a lot of people in the room when Jada was here. She insisted on 3 lighting technicians, 2 makeup technicians, and a wardrobe person, even though I told her it was, you know, it was just audio. But that's how she rolls, and that's why she's Jada De Laurentiis. Anyway, thanks a lot for squandering some more of your time. Talk to you again hopefully next week. In the meantime, America, cook smart.